Today's guest is Australian homeopath Mark Lambrick. Mark initially trained as a naturopath, homeopath, and astrologer almost 3 decades ago, and also completed postgraduate training in counseling and homeopathy. He has worked in mental health, drug and alcohol, community health centers, and prisons as a forensic drug and alcohol clinician and counselor with children, adolescents, and adults. We talk today about Mark's recently released book, Infinite Zero, The Self, Emptiness and the Crisis in Science, a History and Perspective. Why We Are the Way We Appear has haunted Mark throughout his life, and this book is the culmination of a lifetime of work. It has led to numerous journeys through China, India, and many other cultures. As a homeopath, naturopath, astrologer, counselor, and welfare worker, Mark has been actively engaged in the business of helping people by deepening their inquiries into their motivations. This is what he explores on a historical, philosophical, and cultural level throughout this book. The insights will change the way you look at history and the dominant paradigm of science as well as its origins. You can find out more about Mark, book a consult, and purchase his book at www.marklambrick.com. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we get to hang out with Mark Lambrick on the other side of Australia. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks, Eugenie, for having me.
It's a pleasure. I've been wanting to get you on for ages, and your name has been mentioned so many times, and we've had a few chats, and I've had a few chats with your wife. So it's lovely to actually have you on the show. Mark, can you tell us, first off, how you were first introduced to homeopathy?
Okay, when I did naturopathy, that's when I got introduced to it. But I actually, that was in my late 20s, and I had it down as one of my year 12 electives to finish and go on to study. But I looked at this term homeopathy and I thought, geez, I don't know what that is about. And I thought, I need a few years to go to university and just hang out, mess around. And then when I feel a bit more grown up, maybe I can come back and tackle that one. So I had that sense. So I did that in my late 20s. And when I saw it, when I first was taught it, I was amazed. It just opened my world up.
That's amazing. And did you say that naturopathy was an elective in year 12?
It wasn't an elective, sorry, it was one of the courses that I wanted to pursue.
Gotcha. Because I was just going to say, that would be an amazing school that had that as an option to study, hey?
yeah, absolutely. It was either traditional Chinese medicine or naturopathy. But for me, I felt, well, naturopathy is closer to my culture, so I thought I'd do that.
Absolutely. Oh, I've just seen your shirt. Have you got is it from your recent trip to Bali? That's a batik shirt you've got on, hey? Oh, it's beautiful. And then you managed to snag yourself a beautiful wife who is also a homeopath, right?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. We met like about probably 6-7 years after I finished my course in naturopathy. And Kate had been trying to study it part-time as well in the evening and work full-time during the day, and that was really hard. And after a couple of years, when it was offered in northern New South Wales with an Oz study, then she went, I'm going to do that and just be a full-time student. So she tried that. And she wanted me to come up to New South Wales. And I said, well, I'm only going to stay up there if you promise that we stay up there for a long time. And she thought, no, I want to get back down to Melbourne. So she came back to Melbourne and studied it. We got together sort of independently of that through a friend. And one of our first dates was to an astrology conference.
Oh, then you knew she was a keeper. And you're very well connected in the homeopathic community, because so many people that I've spoken to know you. And, you know, we had Gaurang Gaikwad on the show, and Kate sent me his book. And Kate shares a clinic with Leah Golden, Isaac Golden's daughter, right? And it's just like and then also you're friends with Donna, who was on my team. And so you just have your fingers in everywhere in Australian homeopathy. So it's really lovely to have you on.
How many degrees of separation are there in the homeopathic community? Oh, I mean, there's one, yeah. Isn't there?
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. Now, Mark, I wanted to get you on the show because you are now a published author. And for anybody watching on YouTube or Rumble, this is Mark's book, Infinite Zero. I was going to ask you, who did the artwork? It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really good. This group who I got them, a self-publishing group, Wattle okay. and Willow Books. It's a husband-wife team. And so she did the graphic design. And it was her first attempt at that. I tried to, you know, sort of talk about what I wanted. And she came up with that. And I said, thought, it's beautiful. It describes it really well.
It is. Actually, I should read the full title just to really whet people's appetite. Infinite Zero, The Self, Emptiness, and the Crisis in Science, A History and Perspective. Now, if you think that title sounds meaty, the actual content is even more meaty. This was like a good, solid read. And actually, I had a confession to Mark before we started recording that there's like a lot of this really went over my head because it's intense. You can tell that you have put decades of very deep knowledge. And I mean, you have done a lot of traveling, you and Kate, and you've been to India many years and lived there for a couple of years as well. Hey, so you guys have knowledge that, you know, I only dream of. And I can tell that you have worked extremely hard to get all this knowledge into this book in as easier digestible. And you've basically got so much knowledge that you have squeezed into this book, which then at the end, you've come to there's a really nice conclusion at the end that wraps everything up. So the whole book kind of sets you up. So I've said enough. Maybe you can tell our listeners about the book, the journey of writing it and what it is that you're trying to convey through this.
Yeah, thanks, Eugenie. As a very good friend of mine put it, he said, it's like history on steroids.
Absolutely. That is so well said. Because I said to you before, I'm not a history buff at all. So I learned so much history I felt like I did world history in like one book. It was very well said. I think that should be your tagline, history on steroids.
It should. Homeopathic steroids, of course.
Of course, of course. So yeah. Why did you feel it was important to write this? And what was the journey like to this?
Okay. So it's been something that's been on my mind for decades. Like, look, I'm turned 60 this year. So I suppose right from my early 20s, so I was sort of thinking and formulating all of this and fully grasping holism and what holism meant. And we had a philosophical overlay in society of reductionism, which for people who may not be aware, reductionism is the approach that science uses. It's about it's looking at phenomena and reducing it to its smallest fundamental particle, to its causal factor. So everything has a cause in reductionism. Whereas holism is quite different. It's a bit like with Chinese medicine, how you get a relationship. So you get how the organ systems, how other organ systems stimulate it, and then the ones afterwards suppress it. So you've got this whole orchestration happening, and that happens in the wider nature too. So that's holism. So it's not interested in looking at what causes what, but what influences what. And so that's been something that's been going on for a long time. I've thought about, well, how did we come to this? What is this all about? And then so I started inquiring about how we came to see ourselves in the world as we do. It's like we didn't just happen and evolve here. There were steps that occurred. And so I think it was probably in studying astrology that I became really aware of how the ancients used astrology and stuff like that. Like, it's not just that the planets or the fixed stars would be in a certain part of the sky and crossing each other that things would happen, but it was like that both happened simultaneously because it was one system. It's like, so you look out there to know what's going on in here. So we don't do that anymore. We look internally and we assess things internally. Yeah. And so that's quite a big jump to go from out there to in here. So I was really curious about what had happened in history to get us to that place.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you have many different civilizations here as well, which is, I really enjoyed that part of it because history is not my strong point. I'm all about, I don't know, my husband's really into it, but I really enjoyed that there were, you know, it's like there's Greece here. You've got a bit on astrology. There's just, Christianity. That was really interesting. The fall of the Roman Empire, the transition from the first millennium, the Renaissance, colonialism, the universe loses its perfection. It's the next chapter. Just having a quick enlightenment, romantic era. I mean, all of this is just, I mean, it's embarrassing. I clearly need to go read some more history books, but well, now I don't have to because I've read your book. But it was just so interesting to see, you know, you talk about emperors and people and the things that they've done and the decisions that they've made. And it was really interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And I also, in my research of this book, because I researched it for many years and spent 12 years writing it and researching it. And so I came up with a lot of wow moments, you know, and discovery as well too. And it's a beautiful thing learning like that. But one thing I discovered in all of that was that at one point in history, we had all these amazing people. Mind you, men, I just think that there were many amazing women, but we've rubbed them out, haven't we? And so I think that there no doubt were women. And, you know, that, for instance, we had, of the three cultures that I explore, the West, India and China, we had sort of Thales, who was one of the first great philosophers and teachers in ancient Greece. He was born. And we had Pythagoras. Pythagoras was a student of his. Thales told him, look, you know, I can't teach you anything here. You go off to Egypt and you learn amongst the priests and stuff like this. We also had Socrates and we had Plato and we had Aristotle and, you know, many others, Democritus and Zeno. So there were lots of them, but they all occurred within a couple of 200 or 300 years of each other and more like, you know, 100 years within each other. But then at the same time, we had Confucius arise in China and we had Lao Tzu arise in China. And we had Mozi as well, another Chinese philosopher. We also had the Buddha. He was born in this era as well too. And the same with Mahavira, who is the founded Jainism, stuff like that. So all these people arrived in a certain period of time that historians have labelled as the Axial Age. And I thought that was quite astounding that these people are actually the formulators of all the philosophies that we have today that we all pride ourselves on or that we all know really well when we talk about these people. They all were born at the same time in history. How's that? Brilliant. You know, yeah, there are no mistakes. There are no mistakes. That's what I believe anyway. It's like this thing with reductionism that there's a randomness, but this is not random. This is like, you know, we don't get geniuses come up. We do get geniuses come up. Of course we do, you know, but yeah, that actually influence thousands upon thousands of years afterwards, you know, like we're talking, they've influenced the last 3,000 years.
As I was reading it, I was just thinking the monumental task that you must have gone through to write this because there's so many different areas that you're writing on, you know, so many different, so, you know, China and India and Greece and Rome. And there must have been a lot of research, but you did just say it took you 12 years. I can, you know, like probably decades of thinking about it and then 12 years of actually researching it. I can tell that because I did think to myself, I'm sure Kate gave you a hand as well, but really you would really need like a team of writers almost to write and research something like this because that's a lot of research that went into this.
Oh, yeah. I did it on my own, actually.
You do? Wow.
But yeah, I would on public transport, I would read. When I read, I take notes as well too. So I have a lot of notes of books. Every book I read, I take notes on, and copious notes. Also, I would get up at, say, 4:30 and write till about 7:30 and then go off to work and stuff like this. And it's a good time of the day when you can get a chunk done. Also, walking the dogs too, I would talk as I walked and stuff and record a lot of things too. Mm-hmm. Any opportunity I'd use to do that. But, yeah, about the three cultures, it's another aspect of it, because I've come to see that this is my take on it, that the self is made up of three aspects. And there's the individualized self, which is epitomized by the West. And then there's the communal self, the self in terms of a community of people. And that's epitomized by China. And then the self as non-self, as non-existent, which is epitomized by India. And look, these three aspects, those three cultures, while they epitomize these aspects, they don't necessarily own it. And each of us carry with us different proportions of this sort of sense of being an individual, of being part of a community, of actually having those moments of, my God, you know, I'm nothing. There's nothing here behind this, the scary thought, you know, of non-existence. So they're real drivers as to how we perceive ourselves, what we do with our lives and stuff like that. How I see how the West epitomizes individualism is that we worship heroes. We're the great hero worshippers. Also, we invented the Olympic Games. It was invented by Greece, and that replaced the gods and stuff like this. That replaced the Hercules and the Odysseus and stuff like this. So we had modern champions evolve from that. And also, what really struck me when I went to China many years ago, about 35 years ago, was that they addressed their letters the opposite way to what we do. So a Chinese letter will have the country first, then it will have the province next or state next, then it would have the town, the city, then it would have the suburb, then it would have the street, then it would have the unit and the number, and last of all, it would have the name.
Oh, how's that for subliminal messaging?
Yeah,
interesting. It's such a tiny thing, and you think, it's like, oh, wow, that's very interesting.
It's very interesting, but it makes more sense than the other way around. I mean, the postal person isn't going to care about the person's name, you know. So in the West, postie would read it from bottom upwards, you know, sort of thing. Yeah,
it's true. Like that subliminal messaging of country first above self, you know, like, yeah.
Yes. Yes. Good one. Good one. It's very important. And this is very integral. And it's too about that. In China, in lots of other Southeast Asian countries too, the individual is not important. You know, not that they're not important, but there's a place for them. And just like as we're talking about Bali, for instance, and we're talking earlier about names, and their names depict whether they're the eldest or the middle or the youngest or whatever. That's what they mean. Yeah. So they've got their place in the order. And that's very much about this communal sort of self and stuff like this. And the other thing too is this idea of inventors, that in the West, we name inventors. We know who invented the printing press or whatever, but most of us don't know who invented the compass, but it was invented in China because, you know, the watertight bulkhead, so that ships are segmented into sections so that if you get one breached by rocks, the water will fill up, but it won't load up. But no one knows who invented that because it's irrelevant. It's like the individual is a bit irrelevant to life. in some ways. Not for us, but, you know, that's a generalization too. And then with the non-self, with India, I mean, that's epitomized by devotion. And you can't get a more devoted people, really, because they do devotion well. You know, it's these things that struck me and I carried through and developed in this book and could see from the development of their own sense of self that they evolved these concepts too of that part of self and stuff like that, right up to the modern individual.
When I was reading about these three parts of self in your book, it did bring up, you know, some triggers for me because I don't know that in the West, we don't necessarily have it all right here, because I think a lot of the mental illness that we see is due to people that don't have enough of a sense of community or enough selflessness, and they're too self-centered. And then, you know, I think that can lead to depression as well. I think one of the biggest cures for depression is to go and help somebody else, like stop putting the focus on yourself, actually see who you can go out there and help. And that actually makes you feel really good. But then also, yeah, you know, but both of us have just been to Bali and the devotion there. I mean, I had to be a little bit careful what I say, but, you know, I had a chat with our driver who, like you said, they named after whether you're the first, second, third or fourth child, but then they don't even have fifth, sixth, seventh. You just start back from the first child's name if you're the fifth child, which is very, very funny. Or they named after the mountain, you know, one of the mountains, which is Agung. So the names, they're all very similar. But I had a chat with our driver, Agung, and I said to him, you know, like the woman there are so devoted. He was saying they get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to start getting ready for all the ceremony and the things that they do, all the offerings that they do every day. It's just pure devotion. And they don't ever get to actually actualize. It's like there's no self-actualization because it's all about this devotion to their religion. And I mean, that's not completely healthy either. Like you need and it's not good to be completely selfless either, or like the complete communal mindset. I don't know. We need to, as humans, don't seem to like balance. We seem to like extremes, but it'd be so good if we can find a balance in there somewhere, right?
Yeah, it's really true. But also too, that we need a context for our place in the universe too. And we're brought up with these concepts and they become part of our skin too. It's like, you know, to be devoted, they're not lost in that. They're not lost in that. Whereas someone who's brought up to think that they're, you know, a prince or a princess or whatever, if they get forgotten about, then they feel it. They feel it badly, you know. And so you've got that context of self. What's my context in this universe and stuff like that? Yeah.
Is that homeopath mind of us is always trying to go behind? Why is the person doing what they're doing? What's behind that? What's the driving force behind that? And I can, like, you really are the perfect person to have written this book, because that inquiring homeopathic mind of yours is, you can see really how you were getting behind why people were doing all these different things across all the various countries and civilizations over time. But just your title is fascinating, Infinite Zero. What on earth does it mean?
Okay, so what it means is that if you've got the number line, yeah, so you've got number one, you've got 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, so on, yep, and you can keep on adding a zero to the end, to the right-hand side, and you'll keep on getting larger numbers going towards infinity, yep, that's the one.
So I've got it just on
but
YouTube.
Then if you go the other way, great.
Oh, sorry. I've just got an image up here for anybody on YouTube or Rumble. I'll hold it up and you can keep talking, Mark. Sorry.
That's all right. So if you then take the decimal place to the left and you go from 10 to 1 to 0.1 to 0.01 to 0.001 and so on, you go towards zero, but you can never get to zero. Zero does not exist, just like infinity doesn't exist on our plane anyway. I liken the idea of zero is that's what we're getting towards with our homeopathic potencies, is that we're getting closer and closer to zero. And I also, my whole thing about it too is that I think black holes are also, they are as close as you can get to zero before you disappear. Yeah. So black holes, as we know, are immensely powerful. They're at the center of most galaxies or all galaxies. I'm not sure, but I know the Milky Way galaxy has a big black hole in the center. And this black hole, actually, all the solar systems and billions of solar systems in the Milky Way galaxy rotate around it. So it's got all this phenomenal matter and weight to it, and nothing actually contains it, draws it in, you know. And how impressive is that? That's as impressive as infinity. There is a thing, though, and like what you said with the book, like that going to infinity, that graph gets, the gradient gets less and less and less. So you reach a certainty, you reach a predictability, and you don't get much change. Whereas as you go towards zero, the graph just drops so dramatically. So the change is just so infinite. With each dilution, it just gets more and more powerful. It builds up its power. And as we know with the megapotencies, the MM, you know, it's like you're getting towards this sort of zero point where profound shifts can happen.
Yeah, I am loving the megapotencies since I've had Jill on the show, 150-ish somewhere she was. I have been having so much fun with the megapotencies, and I'm just really annoyed that we weren't taught more about them in college, because, you know, but everything happens in its time, right? And it's been an evolution for me, but I've had so many years of fearing using big potencies, even 10 M's. And now I think nothing of prescribing a 10 MM, you know?
Right.
Don't even flinch at it.
Yes, yeah. And I was the same too, you know, and there was this real trepidation. Mm. And I think with us coming from the West, it's like this scientific sort of focus. I call it not only reductionism, but materialism. So we're very steeped in materialism. So going down towards zero is very confronting. It can be. I feel it's very confronting, you know, and you've got to really take a deep breath and go, still going to be here afterwards. But yeah, absolutely. And the joy in actually taking that step and moving forward. I think that there's a certainty within that we need to take from this book too. It's about that with technology, it's been fantastic. We've done so much with it. It's great, but it's actually a shackle that we wear as well too. This is the shortcoming of it, and we need to be aware of it. We need to use it, and we need to be aware of its shortcomings. And what its shortcomings are is that it's so steeped in materialism that we actually are starting to not trust ourselves, and we're trusting technology instead. Like, you get a pathology report and people go, oh, I'll find out what my bloods say and then I'll know for certain what's happening. Or cancer, for instance. You know, there was a program on SBS some years ago where they were interviewing juveniles who had cancer, and the vast majority of them said they had no idea that they had cancer till there was a diagnosis. Mm. And I think there's a certain sense of not being in touch with ourselves, because if you don't actually validate yourself and validate within, and you validate what's material, we're going to run into problems like this. And I love this about homeopathy, that it's all about experience. Mm. That's number one. And we repertorize upon a patient's experience. They try and describe what's going on. And we go, oh, that's really curious. I'd love to. And then we try and find a rubric to match. And it's quite, you can spend hours doing that, can't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're so right. And I think so many clients that will have all, you know, so many symptoms, say, for example, of hyperthyroidism, but their test might not necessarily show because they're not quite clinical yet, but all the symptoms are there. And so sometimes because we trust the pathology test more than we do our own instincts, yeah, things do get missed. And yeah, that's definitely my wish as well, for people to get in touch more with their intuition and just listen to their bodies. We've been so trained from a young age, the second we feel something, to numb it out. And I actually have a really big issue with parents who just dose their kids up with Panadol for something like teething. And yes, teething is painful. Oh, I remember my wisdom teeth coming through when I was 18. It was very painful. And you've got a baby and they're crying and you don't like seeing your child in pain. But really, there's something to be said for wanting to numb your child every time they experience pain, because that's kind of, it puts us into that mental state of, you know, the second I feel pain, it needs to be numbed out. And as a child, you know, that's fine. But when you're an adult, that means alcohol and drugs and everything else, because I don't want to feel that pain, mental, emotional, physical. So let's numb it out. So I think there's a fine line. Obviously, I'm not saying, like, you know, if your child breaks their leg, you know, let them suffer. But if they're in teething pain, we've got homeopathic remedies that we can use to strengthen the vital force. You don't have to go and numb everything out, just so that the person can feel where's the pain. Actually, I'll give you a really good example. How's this? So I ruptured my appendix January last year. And because I haven't used Panadol in like over a decade, I went up to the local hospital here because we live rural. They gave me a Panadol. It took all my pain away. So I went home. And the next day, the pain came back. But I had one interview with Dana Ullman, which I finished first. And then I went to hospital again. And then it had ruptured. So I don't know if I had gone the night before and, you know, they didn't give me the Panadol, they might have seen, okay, it's inflamed, we can give you antibiotics. But I then went home and waited till the next day, so it had ruptured. So there's something to be said for numbing things out instead of actually just feeling what we're feeling, tuning into our bodies.
That's right, exactly. And that's very much part of our history too, a more modern history where we had the advent, you know, Descartes, I think, therefore I am. So we had the Enlightenment where we really started using our brains and started going, this is the center of our world. This is where we order what we see and order life. The backlash of that was that we didn't trust anything out there. We only trusted what happened in here. And we had to test everything to believe it. And so the Romantic period was the backlash to that, to say, yeah, we've got this ordering sort of process happening here, but nature is innately intelligent. And we've got to work with that, understand it, but understand what we're seeing and stuff like this. Homeopathy came during the Romantic period. Okay, it was very much about trusting the intelligence of nature and following that in order to sort of find your prescription, in order to work out what you need and to solve your issues. But after that came the utilitarian period, which was, it was where the backlash from the Romantic period was. And this was the industrialists who came in. They said, we're going to redefine morality. Now, they said that what is good, morally good, is when the majority of the people benefit from a certain thing. Yeah. And they said, and what we're going to see as good is pleasure, and what is bad is pain. Now, that was a really big thing. You know, that before that, we didn't see good as pleasure and bad as pain. It only came in then. That was 170 years ago. So since then, it's been really well evolved, that this idea of pleasure and pain, and that we avoid pain at all costs, and that pleasure is something that we need. And so that's driven modern society apart from the reductionism. You know, there's a whole host of things going on here, and we could go on for hours.
Whereabouts can people find the book? Do you sell it yourself, or do you have a, like you mentioned, about a publisher? Where do people get copies of the book? Because you were very kind enough to send me a complimentary copy, so I don't actually know where people buy it from. Thank you. I was just saying before, I've had so many authors on the show, but you are one of only three that sent me a complimentary copy of your book. So I really appreciate that, because I spend so much money on buying books, which I don't mind. Like, that's the one thing I have No qual spending money on books because I love them. They're my friends. But where can people
purchase? You're a homeopath too.
Yeah, so it goes with the territory. Yes. That is, I have never met a homeopath that is not obsessed with books. Ever.
That's it. Oh, we are. We never stop reading. And it's funny how many of us go, oh, no, I never read for pleasure.
Yeah.
I just read. Because exactly. I'm curious.
Exactly. So where can people purchase a copy of your book and where can they get it internationally as well?
Yeah, that's good. Look, on my website will be the thing. As far as internationally goes, I'll have to actually put that link up there because I've got to make an agreement with the people who are the publishers of my book that it's an international firm. So they've got outlets and distributors in the UK and Canada and States. So basically, yeah, I've got to actually get that. That's my next step.
We can always update it in the show notes. And the other thing is that in our Homeopathy Hangout podcast Facebook group, we can also, once that's established, we can also pop it in there as well.
Great.
Just marklambrick.com.
Now, that's it.
You do astrology as well, do you?
Yeah.
And counseling as well. Have you got any particular like niche that you specialize in?
No, I consider myself a student of life. The thing is that what happened when I started studying naturopathy and homeopathy combined at the same time was I'd heard that astrology was a good marriage for herbalism, at least anyway. I thought, oh, that's good. I'll give it a try. And, you know, look, I didn't know much about it. And I just thought, well, learn it and see if it works. And if it works, then great. If it doesn't, well, you tried it anyway. And then I've become pretty obsessed by that since. So, again, I've been doing all of that for the past 30 years. And I suppose at the same time, probably since my late 20s, I've been working in welfare. I also worked in nursing homes, Peter MacCallum, a private hospital. Yeah. And, you know, about 10 years in prisons and as a youth worker, working on the streets and stuff like that in the city and as a drug and alcohol worker. And in refuges and in institutions. Yeah, so I've done a lot of this as well as doing all of the above.
That is pretty intense. When you went into the prisons and like on the streets, would you use homeopathy or naturopathy or a bit of everything, astrology or?
Yeah, look, for a period of time there, I was employed as a primary health worker, as a primary health youth worker. So then I did work with homeopathy and I'd get kids supplements and all of that and refer them to Kate as well too and stuff like this. And so did all of that. And in the prisons, no, basically because I have another, I suppose, hat where I'm a drug and alcohol worker. So I'd assess prisoners as they were coming out of prison after a life sentence or after a long time in prison or maybe a short time, maybe 6 months or 25 years or whatever. I would assess them. I'd ask them about their lives. What has led to this point? Where they're at and what are their insights? What do they see and what have they done, you know, and what are their reflections about what they're coming back out to and stuff like that. So I'd write a report and I'd assess their risk level and then I'd sort of make treatment recommendations and stuff like that.
That and sounds like a whole other book. Sounds like another book that you could write about your interviews with them.
Yeah, thousands of interviews, yeah.
I've often thought, well, I wish there's a way that we can get homeopathy into the prisons to help with,
amazing.
I don't even know how you'd go about that. So I'm asking for myself because we've got a women's prison. And in fact, on my way to work, I drive past two prisons. Whenever I see it, I often think, I just wish I could get in there and help people. But were they open to homeopathy? Like, could you actually use that? Or was it more the counselling that you would use there?
More counselling, but they wouldn't be into homeopathy at all.
But it's hard here in Australia. Hey, this, like, they're just not open to it. But I think, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what we need to do to change that, but it's time for a change. It's time that we ramp things up a little bit over here, I think.
It is time for a change. Absolutely. Absolutely. You're the person for it.
We all are. We all are. You are too. Every single one of us, every single homeopath that it doesn't matter how few or how many clients they see, every single one of us, every time we talk about homeopathy to our friends and our family, or we purchase a remedy, or we support another homeopath, or, you know, all of it helps. And all of us are helping to grow homeopathy.
Yeah. And the disconnect that we've got that we see with people with going, absolute what? Homie what? You know, yeah. How does this work? Yeah. What? Yeah. You know, and you ask a doctor and you can do it. I've had one before say, well, here's a glass of water. That's your homeopathy.
Mm-hmm. Mark, are you still taking on new clients?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, and you're seeing people over Zoom as well, or only in person?
Yeah. No, by Zoom and at Leah Golden's clinic and, yeah, yeah.
Oh, amazing. And so, she's got a new clinic. Did you guys move along to the new clinic? Did you? Oh, cool. Oh,
it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Oh. It's so good. I'm going to run astrology courses from there too.
That is cool. You'll have to send me details. Are they in person or online? So in person from
both.
Okay, amazing. To be fair, I have been too scared to learn about astrology. I know a lot of homeopaths, I've had several homeopaths on the show who use astrology as well. I'm too scared to go there because I have heard that that is at least as vast as homeopathy, if not more. And I'm just like, I already have so many homeopathy books that I could not even read them all in 10 lifetimes. So I'm too scared to go down the astrology path, but it does sound like can be such a good in your homeopathic consultation and really help you to see the person on a deeper level, hey, and know things about them that they don't even know about themselves.
Well, exactly. Or it could prompt you to go into a particular area going, I'm going to tease this out a bit more because you need to know about those sort of spots. And, you know, just a context to that. Astrology is the first science, you know, everything evolved from that. Mathematics evolved from astrology. Mm. It didn't evolve from measuring up land and for property or whatever, but it evolved from the ancients wanting to know how many degrees something was from something and stuff like this. So mathematics evolved from astrology.
Interesting. Mark, any final message that you want to leave our listeners with?
No, look, I really hope that you enjoy the book. If you get it, it is a big read, as you were saying. It's something you can put down and pick up and stuff like that, or you can reread. I think it's been a labor of love. And
I was about
I'm really
to say this.
To finally have it out.
This is a labor of love. You can see that you have put blood, sweat, and tears and ridiculous hard work into writing this. So this is definitely, what a beautiful testament to leave behind. It's a legacy.
I know. Really. I can't agree more. I can't agree more with you, Jenny.
Amazing. So your website is marklambrick.com, and you're also on Facebook as well, if people want to follow you there. Are you on Instagram?
Mainly Facebook and on the website.
Great. Excellent.
Yeah. They're the ones I use. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely don't. I mean, I'm like, it took me ages to get onto Instagram, and I'm like, I am not going on TikTok.
And then my email address is marklambrick@gmail.com.
So. Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Mark. I really appreciate it. Now you need to give your wife a nudge and get her on the show as well.
Will do. Will do. I'll prod her along. That's great. I love your shows. They're great.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.